Well, good morning and happy April 1st, one of my wife's favorite days of the year. I must say I had a very satisfying experience this morning as getting ready in our bathroom, and I heard this loud shriek, scream from the other bathroom, and I walked out and my wife said, "What's a human head doing in the toilet?" Now, I just tell you that because I've got to get through the rest of the day, and I know that it's only just begun. So, I also regret that I have a cold that I picked up somewhere, so the volume and the zeal of the precious truths we're going to consider this morning is going to be somewhat muted in my ability to be able to verbalize it, so hang in with me. Paul wrote to the Ephesian Christians in his letter to them, "I pray that you, being rooted and established in love, may have power, together with all the saints, to grasp how wide and how long and how high and how deep is the love of Christ. And to know this love that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled to the measure of all the fullness of God." How glibly we speak about the love of Christ. And so the last couple of weeks we have been considering something of its dimensions. And I know that it's affected me in studying this, preparing it, and I know it's affected some of you in these last couple of weeks. And to think that we are only gathering a few flakes of the gold when we walk constantly upon the deep mines of the love of Christ that we have never really plumbed. I say that because Paul says in this same letter back in chapter 2, in verse 6, that God has raised us up with Christ and seated us with Him in the heavenly realms in Christ Jesus, in order that in the coming ages, in all the ages to come, millions and millions of years without end, He might show the incomparable riches of His grace expressed in His kindness to us in Christ Jesus. 10 million years from now, if you belong to Jesus Christ and you're with Him, you'll say, "I've plumbed more of the depths of the love of Christ, and I can't wait for the new and fresh discoveries that await me still to come." So when we've gone through these 3 weeks, we dare not think, "Oh, well, now I know something about the love of Christ." Brothers and sisters, it's vast. And we've known a little bit more, but just a little bit of all that there is. And isn't it true that most of our troubles are because we don't comprehend and we don't believe the love of Christ? Our hearts are really not fixed upon grasping, comprehending, and delighting, resting in that love. So what we've done is taken 1 Corinthians 13, 15 descriptions of love. Observe that love is most tested when it's under stress. Love is most draws attention to itself, is most delightful to see when it is expressed under stress. And we have looked at the last hours of Christ's life and we've seen so far just some of the 12 examples of His love expressed, first of all, in the Passover toward His disciples and then in His arrest. We've seen how Jesus began by saying, "I have eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you." an earnest desire for their fellowship, even though, as we look at it, there's nothing that they seem to offer to him of any comfort or support or insight in what he was going through. In fact, when they are at their worst, in their self-centeredness, arguing about who's going to be greatest in the kingdom, it's then that he responds with gentleness, tenderness, to teach them again that status is not the thing to seek in the kingdom. It's rather servanthood. And then he even encourages them by pointing out that they all have stood with him and that he's conferring on all of them a kingdom. And then he particularly goes out of his way to encourage the one that's going to most break his heart in the next hours, Peter, who will deny him 3 times. And so he points out that, Peter, I've prayed for you and you will not fail. When you're restored, then this experience of failure and my grace will be used to strengthen your brothers. And then he goes out to the Garden of Gethsemane and he gathers just 3 and says, come, watch with me. And they can't. They fall asleep. They fail him again and again. But even then, he doesn't rebuke them that they've let him down, but rather he says, pray that you won't enter into temptation. So we've seen again and again and again. And then in his arrest, Judas comes to betray him with a kiss. Despicable hypocrisy. And Jesus doesn't turn on him and level him. He looks him in the eye and he asks, Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? Using his name for the connection. Showing that he knows that it's a betrayal. Showing that this kiss is the greatest of hypocrisy, that he's not simply betraying a friend, but the Son of Man who will judge him in that last day. He then turns to those who come to arrest him, and his concern is not for himself, his own safety, whether he's harmed or not. It's, don't lay hands on these men. Let them go. Concerned that they would be joined with him in the execution that's to come. And then we see, even at that moment, that when Peter, in his one act of bravado, seeks to cut off the high priest's servant's ear, cut off his head, and instead misses and just cuts off his ear, that Jesus stops and he heals the ear of the servant of his bitterest enemy. Tenderness, using his power in the last display of his miracles, not for himself, but for his enemy. What kindness, what tenderness. And now this morning, we look at 5 examples of Jesus' love during his trial and his crucifixion. So the 8th example, Jesus look at Peter without rejection. Just look at Peter without rejection. Luke chapter 22, verse 54, then seizing him, they led him away and they took him into the house of the high priest. Peter followed at a distance. But when they had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and had sat down together, Peter sat down with them. A servant girl saw him seated there in the firelight. She looked closely at him and said, this man was with him. But he denied it. Woman, I don't know him. Now picture the courtyard. This is the palace of Caiaphas the high priest. Large palace designed so that all the rooms that are made in something like a square rectangle face inward toward this beautiful little courtyard. It's a large courtyard. Large enough that the crowd has assembled here. The guards with Jesus are there. And somewhere toward the center of it, they've made a little fire because it's a cool night. Peter has come to join them. He got in because John was known to the officials, so John gained entrance for Peter to come in. They're at a distance. They want to see. They love the Lord. So John and Peter are looking to see what's going to happen to him. But all the adrenaline has drained from his body concerning the Garden of Gethsemane battle. And now he is seeing that Jesus is in serious trouble. And he's scared. He sits there and this servant girl starts looking at him. She kind of zeroes in on him and says, "Aren't you one of those that was with him?" And now in his fear, he denies it. "Ah, I don't know him. What are you talking about?" And then Luke goes on, verse 58. A little later, someone else saw him. Matthew tells us it's another servant girl, the doorkeeper. And she says, "You're also one of them." Now, it's worth noting that we're not talking here about armed guards. We're not talking about officials. We're talking about a couple of servant girls, which prompts in me the reflection of how ashamed I am that I at times will deny my association with Jesus toward people whose opinion really matters very little. I mean, you're carrying a Bible, you're listening to a Christian CD or something, and some stranger passes by and you're concerned about what they're going to think. We're concerned about what somebody who will just be fleetingly passing through our life thinks about us, that we're one of those Christians associated with Jesus. And we're ashamed of being associated with the Lord of glory, the Lord of the universe. We're ashamed of Him. How He should be ashamed of being associated with us. And yet Hebrews 2 tells us He was not ashamed to call us brothers. Then in the great assembly, He says, "These are my brothers. These are the ones I associate myself with, you and me." And yet we're consumed with what people think about us being associated with Him. Ridiculous, isn't it? Another hour passes. The tension's building. It's very tedious. And of course, Peter can't keep his mouth shut. And so gradually, they begin to notice his Galilean accent. And here's what Luke says.